world, Ecclesiastes asks the big and hard questions of life. And they're questions I'll get into that we often just want to avoid. We don't want to dive into. And it the book will show us, it kind of captures the futility and frustration of the life that we find ourselves in. So again, Proverbs, we have these general principles, even Karina read out of those, and we have, we're going to grow in wisdom and how to navigate. Part of growing in that wisdom is knowing that life is complex. Life is hard. How do you navigate the challenges and hardships of life? Because it's wisdom. It takes wisdom to navigate when things don't go the way that you intend. It doesn't take much wisdom to navigate, hey, everything's kind of going smooth. You don't really need it. But when things don't go the way that we intend, so the book of Ecclesiastes helps us ask those hard, big questions. But the author is not just like naive or cynical. He's also, but he's realistic and yet hopeful. So we could just read the book, and even some of the stuff that we'll read today is like, okay, that's just depressing. But if you need to kind of get to the bottom of it to have hope. I'll say later that he actually demolishes to rebuild. And so to build a life that actually has hope, because he's trying to help us, this is the second reason, to help us worship the one true God. So what we'll see throughout the book of Ecclesiastes is God is this mighty creator, that God's the sovereign Lord, that even in the midst of all the trouble, he is over it all, that God's the ultimate wisdom, God's the ultimate ruler. One of the values of our church is that we want to help people know God. And then the last thing that we'll see is that it's going to teach us how to live for God and not just for ourselves. So the book of Ecclesiastes goes through like everyday issues that we all navigate. He goes through issues of money and sex and relationships. He goes through issues of power. He dives into the issues of life and death. And so it's just a really practical and helpful book for navigating the challenges and the complexity of life. And it's written for those. It's written to these Israelites, so it's written for the people of God, but it's also written for like the agnostic or the skeptic, the ones that maybe have heard about this God and say like, okay, that doesn't line up with the world that I'm living and experiencing. It's written for those who are searching for meaning. It's written for those that want to learn and grow. And so for us, we want this book to help us ask those big, hard questions. We want us to help us know God more and better. And then we want it to help us navigate the things of life. And the book starts out in verse 1. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." And so it starts out with this figure is called the preacher and kind of who he's writing to. And the preacher, the word for preacher, there's a couple things that are just hard to translate into English. The Hebrew word is Koheleth. Mike's probably got a long word study on it. But it's a word that drives at the idea of preacher, of teacher. He's think of like a speaker or a professor. In the New Testament, it's translated ecclesia, which in the New Testament, that means the church. It means the gathering. So that's where we get the word Ecclesiastes. It drives at the idea of one who gathers people. One who gathers God's people and teaches and teaches wisdom. And so what you have is, it's the words of the preacher. This is probably getting into the weeds a little bit more, but the book is framed like there's the author, and he is just introducing the preacher. He's introducing, then he's going to lay out all this teacher's ideas. And at the end, the author comes again and kind of critiques it all. So think about it. There's somebody that wrote it, and what he is writing is this wisdom of the preacher, of the teacher, of the wisdom. And it says this preacher, teacher, is the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. And there's a lot of different views on who that is. Some people just read it and like, oh, son of David, king of Jerusalem, wisdom. He's talking about King Solomon. He's the son of David. There's a lot of people that I like respect that are a lot smarter than me that don't think that that's the case. If they thought it was just King Solomon, it was like they would have written, "This is King Solomon," like they did in Proverbs and all these other books. They didn't do that. So some people think it's like just some other descendant of David. Other people think it's just a teacher in Israel that's using a Solomon-like persona. And so it doesn't really matter in that sense. But there's just to know, there's different views on who actually wrote this. But no matter or regardless of who wrote it, it's meant to represent the king's wisdom. It's meant to represent God's ultimate wisdom. And so whether that was Solomon, whether that it was some guy acting like Solomon, so we better understood it, it is the wisdom of God. And he's writing to the people of Israel. Most people think that he would have been written to people that had kind of like left the temple and they were living outside the temple. They had moved from like an agrarian society more into like a city. So they're no longer like in the wilderness or anymore. They're like in a city. So it's helping these people navigate life in this kind of complex or new world for them. Reichen said this. He says, the teacher or the preacher addresses the Israelites who were preoccupied. This just kind of hits home. Who were preoccupied with all sorts of social and economic issues. The volatility of the economy, the possibility or potential of wealth, their inheritance, kind of where they stood as a people, their social status, plus the fragility of life and the ever-present shadow of death. So that's who he's writing to. Like, that rings some bells for me. It just describes our world too, just that idea that we're preoccupied with social and economic issues and just the challenges of the world. But what's great about the book of Ecclesiastes is it just doesn't settle for like sort of contrite or like passive answers. He actually pushes through it. One person said that he's like an explorer. Like, he doesn't just kind of like, oh, that's really complex, that's really hard, and just like, I'm not going to climb that mountain. He actually starts climbing the mountain. He takes these sort of questions or these thoughts or these challenges about life and death, and he just keeps pressing deeper and deeper and deeper. He's like the ultimate three-year-old. Why? And he doesn't sort of just settle for a clean, small answer. He wants to know more. And you're like, sometimes you're like, you can't know more. like this is where this conversation ends. You're not going to know. So, but he helps us ask these right questions, and they're ones, truthfully, that we often avoid. And in doing so, in asking these hard questions and not settling for easy answers or actually talking about the challenges or complexity of life, it sets us up for the hope that the rest of the scriptures bring. So in order to get real answers, you have to ask hard questions. In order to deal with hard things, to get to like real hope, you need to get to the bottom of it all. And so he's really just setting the whole thing up. Again, he's demolishing to build a better life, to build a stronger life, to have a deep faith in the things that are going on. And so the first 11 verses, he kind of lays out his perspective. So we got the preacher, this through the series, even some of the commentaries, like, how cool, people, and they'll say, Solomon said, and then other people are like, well, they all call him different things. So we'll call him the preacher, we'll call him the teacher. And he gives us his perspective on life in verses 2 through 11. He says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanities of vanities, all is vanity. I'll get into what that means. And then he goes in to prove his point that life is all vanity, it's all kind of smoke, it's all meaningless. He says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? He says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. He says, the sun rises and the sun goes down. There's a rhythmic, poetic thing that's going on here as well. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. So it goes back. It says, the wind blows to the south and and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. Everything just kind of keeps going and going and going. He says, all things are full of weariness. That can be your like life verse or your verse for the day. All things are full of weariness. I told you he was honest. He's going to be honest about what the things of life have. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. He says there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come from afar. So I'll give a quick overview of what he's driving at. It can read sort of depressing, but again, we're going to demolish in order to build. So his perspective, he starts in verse 2. He kind of gives a thesis of the whole book. He says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So 5 times in that one verse, he uses this word vanity. It's used 38 times, nearly 40 times in the 12 chapters of the book. This word for vanity is used. Some translations call it meaningless. So he's like, meaningless, meaningless, it's all meaningless. And so, again, starting low. And the word literally means hevel. Even vanity or meaningless, don't kind of grasp all of it, because he'll go into stuff and say this has meaning and this has meaning and this is better than that. So if something's better than one thing, that means that thing has more meaning. But that word hevel really means it's breath or vapor or a puff of smoke. I like that puff of smoke idea. If you think about smoke, you can't quite grasp it, right? You see it, you go and you kind of grab it and just whisk away. It dissipates, it goes away. And he's saying life is like that. It's elusive, it's fleeting, it's transient. It's the nature of human existence is what he's saying. He's talking about the brevity of life. Think about smoke. It's there and then it's gone. It's short. It's brevity of life. Life is short. Life is elusive. Life is puzzling. He says the whole thing is futile. When you try and grasp it, when you try and hold on to it, not you, when I try to hold on to it, it's futile. You can't grab smoke. And you can't grab life. And then he begins a sort of quest to support his thesis. In verse 3, he says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? That word gain, it's a business term. It means profit at the end. It's like, are you finishing in the black? Right? So you got a real estate deal, are we going to make money on this? Are we going to finish in the black? We got to sell the house for a certain price so it can finish in the black. Or a business, if it's not going well, it ends in the red. So he says, what at the end of it all, what have you really gained in your whole life? It's not like you're gone, everything's gone, and you're just gone, right? And so he says it is it's this gain. So what do you gain at the end of it for which he toils under the sun? He's basically asking, what's the point of it all? You ever stop, kind of let you get yourself there? I had this, I share this a lot. I had my sort of Ecclesiastes moment. I wasn't philosophical or kind of contemplative enough to ask this, or I didn't know this is what was going, but I was 25. I was with, I was out in Pebble Beach with my 2 best friends, and kind of that was my goal in life. I was there. I was playing golf with my 2 best friends in literally the most beautiful place in the world. And I sort of looked around and kind of saw everybody there. And again, this not in a judgmental way, but I was like, man, these people are not very happy. They've gotten to the end of their life and they're kind of grumpy to be around and they're kind of not real nice and they're there. And so it was there. And so I was like, man, I kind of arrived and I had this sort of is this it moment? It was there, and I was like, man, I had a good family, and I had a lot of friends, and I had a good job, and I was with my buddies, and, at that time, I had, the golf portion of it, and then we were going out in San Francisco, where, my best friend lived, so we went all the best places to go. This was it, and my sort of response was, is this it? It was there. We got questions in the back. I'll talk to you about it after. I'll talk to you about it after.
And I've been listening for this entire sermon way before I'm an example for tearing down to build up.
We'll talk about it, buddy. Just 1 minute, all right? Thanks, bud. And he says, what does a man gain by all his toil under the sun? And what he's driving at is under the sun. He's talking about what is, he's talking about life from a human perspective. Life from just looking at it. If you're human, you're born, and you just look out. And everything you see, that's what he's talking about when he's saying life from a human, life under the sun. Everything as it is. What are we left with when we take God out of it all? And he's saying it's vanity. It's meaningless. It doesn't last. It's under the sun. In that under the sun, he's given us a hint, though. Because if there's this life under the sun, he's going to point us to the one that's over the sun. The one that created it all. There's a really helpful video by the Bible Project, and he again drives at this idea that he's trying to deconstruct all the ways that we find meaning and purpose apart from God. That's life under the sun. This passage, it's in the Bible, it doesn't even mention God. Does it? He's opening up this book about wisdom and life, and it doesn't even mention God at all. It's life under the sun. And so if it's based on wealth, he's saying, hey, you're going to have to leave it all behind anyway. And you don't even get to decide when you leave it behind what those people you're leaving behind it are going to do with it. If your whole life is built on your career, just think about the amount of stress your career puts on you. I don't care if you have the number one job that you absolutely love. There is still stress involved in it. If it's driving after status, it's fleeting. If it's pleasure, like we're never satisfied with more, there's always more. Jesus put it this way in Mark 8:34-37. I think there's a slide for this. Mark 8:34-37, it says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? What does it matter if you gain everything under the sun, but you lose your life, you lose your soul? And then he goes into this, what one commentator called these, he just describes it as endless rounds. He talks about these patterns in nature where he got into the sun rises and the sun goes down and then it goes back to its place. The sun just chases itself every day, right? Goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down. He says the wind, it just goes around and around. Now, you guys out on the boats and stuff like that, or I'm going on my bike rides, like sometimes like, ah, I'm riding into the wind. And then I'm, you know, I was out Thursday, I think it was, and I was like, ah, I'm going pretty good. No. The wind was just going that way that day. Because then when I turn around, I'm like, I'm not going very good, right? But the wind just goes where, yes, the wind just sort of goes where it wants. And it just kind of goes the same way all the time. He says that the water flows, but it doesn't fill. He's been talking about the Dead Sea, where these rivers continually just run into it, but it never fills up. There's no place for the water to run out of the Dead Sea, but it never fills up. It never just overflows, right? The water just repetitively goes, goes, and goes. Now, people are like, oh, it goes into the air and then it comes back. Yeah, but what he's saying is that the streams just go and fill it up, but it never accomplishes a goal. It never gets there. And he uses these patterns of human experiences. He says, all things are full of weariness. He says, a man cannot utter it. He's talking about everything that you say. It says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. For the amount of stuff that we can see, we're still not satisfied. It never fills us up. Think about it even with phones. Like, we can see everything. Even with the travel we have available to us, we can go anywhere. We can see everything. But it never satisfies. It never fills you up. It never, if that's just it, it's never there. And it says, what the nor the ear filled with hearing. We can gather more information. We have access to more information. We can hear more things than we ever could in history of humanity. But it hasn't changed anything. It all just kind of keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. He says we hear these things, and it just keeps coming in like the ocean. We take it in with our eyes, and then we say these things, but it doesn't result in anything different. He's driving home to the fact that life is short. We even our kids, Leslie said, oh, Will's getting tall. And he is. Or if people have like, hey, you have kids in elementary school and then your kids are in college, what's the number one thing you hear? Like, hey, it goes fast. It goes fast. It goes fast, right? Because life is short. Or you get a little bit older and you're like, we're getting into the 40 range. I was like, okay, Dr. Twaker, we got some tests that we haven't had to take before that we got to start taking, right? Because we're on the downhill slide of it, that life is actually short. That life is elusive. It's that vanity thing. Life is elusive. And we try to grab onto it. We try to grab hold of it. One of our favorite presents from BB is on holidays, like birthdays and stuff like that, she gets us a cleaning lady. And when you got three kids, like the cleaning lady blank check is like an amazing thing. Because, you know, like, and Corinne, this is not anything on Corinne. Like, we try and keep it as clean as we can and blah, 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 all that stuff. But, like, literally, it's all clean. And then they come home, and it just gets blown up, like, from that. And so to have somebody coming in. So it was Thursday, I believe. Friday. Cleaning lady came. Like, I have been, like, we didn't even put the vacuum cleaner away. I'm like, oh, there's a little spot. Let me get that. And there's a thing. Like, let me get that off the counter. Right? I'm, like, trying to keep it. I'm like, I need to keep this thing clean. But it's elusive. It's impossible. It's going to get overrun. But I want to grab hold of the cleanliness. I want to grab hold of the order. And I want to just get in it. But you can't. You get overrun by it. Life is repetitive. Right? You're doing laundry and you're literally wearing what's making it repetitive. And you're going to get another pile that's hard to fold, that it's harder to put away. And then you get another one, or it's the dishes and you just think you get done and then it just goes. Work, it's the same thing. You show up each day. Right? And when you're in sales, like you're getting paid on like what happened like 3 months ago. They don't care about that anymore. They care about what you're doing now. So even like your reward, it's elusive. It's repetitive. And ultimately, it all ends in death, is what he says. He says, there's not a thing of which it is said that is new. It has already been. There is no remembrance of former things. And we almost want to pretend that these things aren't true. And so we begin to just distract ourselves. We distract ourselves with whatever it is, with more information to take in or more things to do. And we just distract ourselves. But what I love about this is like, no, ask those hard questions so then we can live true life. He says, there is nothing new under the sun. At the core, we've always had what we've had. It's just new forms of it. And so we can act like we're like advanced and stuff. He's like, no. You got babies now. You had babies back then. You had work now. You had work back then. Like you're trying to explore black holes now. He's like, it's just adventure. Like there's always been adventurers. They were going out onto the sea. There's nothing new. At the core of everything, it's all the same thing, just over and over again in new forms. We've always had war. Now it's just like we can kill more people easier. But there's always been war. There's always been music. You go back to Genesis 4. There's always been music. We just have new forms of it. Does that make sense? He's saying we're not advancing anywhere. It's the same things over and over again, just in different forms. And so he's like, don't try to find your value in things that are under the sun because it doesn't last. And again, I keep coming back to this point that he has only demolished in order to build. And what he's showing is that if nothing has meaning apart from God, if nothing lasts, in verse 11 says there is no remembrance of it. Like I thought about this. I'm like, man, am I just like a bad family member? But I only remember my grandma and great-grandma and grandpa on one side. And then the other side, it's just my grandma and grandpa. I don't even know the names of my great grandma and grandpa on the other. And so like somebody like, oh, you're a terrible historian of your family. But you can only remember, like, just think about it. Your family you only remember like two, maybe three generations, maybe four. Like, that's why we have like ancestry.com. So I'm like everybody else. You actually have to have a computer program. Go look up who your family is. Now, if your family doesn't remember you a couple generations later, guess what? Nobody else does either. Right? And so he's like, hey, if you're building it up on this, it's not gonna last. Nothing lasts under the sun because it's temporal and it's forgotten. And he does this because when we get that, when we understand that, then we're ready to hear, as Kidner said, as the good news which it is, that everything matters through the one who is above the sun. He's setting this whole thing up. Because things under the sun that don't matter, but the one, there's one above the sun, and everything he does matters. Everything that's done for him and by him and through him matters. He's eternal. He's not temporal. It won't be forgotten. And so that's how we can find purpose in the midst of all this. And again, we demolish to rebuild. So his point here in all of this, first under finding purpose, is that we would trust in the one that's over the sun. It brings meaning, it brings purpose, it brings happiness, it brings joy in a world that's subjected to futility. What Jesus was doing by coming to earth as a human, he was breaking the cycle. He was breaking the cycle of futility. Jesus come in, it says that there's nothing new. Jesus came in and did something that is new. He's doing something that lasts forever. Right? That's where we celebrated last week on Good Friday. And on the cross, Jesus takes the futility of the world upon himself. He takes on our sin. He takes on our brokenness. He takes on the things that don't make sense upon himself. And he resurrects and gives us a new way. He gives us a new path. He gives us things that have new life and new meaning. And so when we trust in the one that is over the sun, it brings meaning and purpose and happiness. It says in Romans 8:20, it says, for the creation was subjected to futility. That's the same word as vanity that we see in vanity, vanity, it's all vanity. The world was subjected to futility. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected to it. God said, hey, if you turn from me, if you sin, if you don't live according to the principles and the life that I've set out to you, it's gonna cause futility. It's going to cause brokenness. It's going to cause destruction. It's going to cause death. And he was right. That's why we experience futility. And it says, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And Jesus comes in and he enters in the futility and he takes it upon himself and he sets us free. He sets us free to live lives that have meaning and purpose and value. It's the second point in finding purpose, that we can experience the new life that God brings. So if he says there's nothing new, Jesus is bringing everything that is new. There should be a slide for this, Aiden. Jesus is bringing everything new. Jesus brings new life. Jesus ushered in a new creation. Jesus said in Revelation 21, I am making all things new. He's not just saying like one day I will make all things new. He says, I am making all things new. So he is using those things. He is creating new things. And it says in 1 Corinthians 15:58, in the Lord Jesus, your labor is not in vain. It's not vanity. Doing the laundry over and over and over again is not vanity. It's bringing purpose. It's bringing order. It's bringing restoration. It's coming alongside what God is already doing. And so when we align our purposes with God and what he's doing to restore and make all things new, it has eternal significance. So then all of a sudden, investing in your kids, helping them know God and follow God, helping them flourish matters. Your career matters. And it's the new life that God brings through that. And then the final thing that we can find purpose with is that through Jesus, we find rest and find refreshment in our limitations. That we don't have to try and do everything. That we don't have to try and grasp hold of life. That we begin to just accept the life that is given to us. And we can enjoy it. How much of our struggle is just trying to grasp and hold? It's me trying to keep the house clean. It's just grasping but they're saying, how do you live life under the sun? Accept it. Accept everything is hevel. Accept everything is fleeting. Accept that it's out of your and my control. In the book of Ecclesiastes, it's in that Bible Project video, it says there's that six times at the bleakest sort of moments of the book of Ecclesiastes, it talks about the gift of God. In the brokenness, in the challenge, the call is simply to enjoy the simple things as they come. And so the way to find rest and refreshment is to not just try and grab hold of everything, but to navigate and enjoy and learn from what happens. It allows us to understand that things like friendship and our family and work and a good meal and whatever the vocation we have is for that season, that our health, that this place that God's put us, that we can actually see those as gifts of God and just enjoy them and take them in. And if they're the hard things that we're going through, that God's doing something in that. There's a woman, Joni Erickson Tada, who is paralyzed. She dove into a pool or a river or something like that and was paralyzed all her life. She writes the most fascinating and amazing things about how she's known and experienced God through that there, right? So I'm not saying it's, even when it goes bad, that we can know that God can use those things. In 1 Corinthians 10:31, it says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And then so we can know, no matter what life brings at us, we can enjoy and rest in Him.